Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With the House Intelligence Committee in shambles after what appears to be deliberate sabotage by its chairman, Devin Nunes, we'll begin with the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian meddling and possible collusion with Trump in the 2016 election, which is moving at glacial speed. Tim Mack, a senior correspondent at The Daily Beast, joins us to discuss his reports that there are no qualified full-time staff members of the 7 working part-time on the Senate Russian inquiry and that no interviews have been conducted with key individuals. Then, as White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer tries to reassure Trump's base that priorities have not changed, we will look into President Trump's backing down on his repeated campaign promise to build a wall along the border that Mexico will pay for, which was supposed to be funded in this week's spending bill. Sonia Nazario, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her 6-part investigative series, Enrique's Journey, which is now a best-selling book, joins us to discuss her article at the Los Angeles Times, How to Secure the Border. Spoiler alert, a wall won't do it. We will discuss how much cheaper solutions will help solve the problem that a $20 billion wall will certainly not do. Then finally, as the general in charge of U.S. operations in Afghanistan refuses to dispute claims that Russia is sending weapons to the Taliban, we will examine the charges and what evidence might support them with Marvin Weinbaum, who served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan for the United States Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. He is a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois and a resident scholar at the Middle East Institute and the author of The Future of Afghanistan. And we will assess whether there are other reasons why we appear to be losing America's longest war other than the possibility of perfidious behavior by Putin. And joining us now is Tim Mack, who's a senior correspondent for The Daily Beast, where he covers campaign politics, national security, and Congress. His latest article at The Daily Beast is, Senate Democrats have serious concerns about Trump-Russia probe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Mack.
Thanks so much.
And in terms of the work that you've been doing, looking into the Senate Intelligence Committee and why it doesn't seem to be producing very much, pointing out in particular how understaffed it is, it appears that your reporting in the Daily Beast has spurred a little bit of action over there, not necessarily with the Republican chair, but certainly with the Democrats. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are expressing concerns that they haven't publicly expressed previously. And a number of folks on the committee are saying, hey, if we're going to do a serious investigation into Russia and possible ties between the Kremlin and Team Trump, we really need to staff up. We need more resources. We need more investigative muscle.
But in the broader sense, is there something going on here with Devin Nunes and the antics that he did, which clearly blew up the House committee and made it dysfunctional? And it seems to be coming back rather slowly. But there were some very important witnesses about to testify before that happened. In general, when you drop a few cruise missiles on Syria or a big bomb in Afghanistan or threaten war with North Korea, it does take it off the headlines. In the broader sense, is there the politics of distraction going on here?
I think there are a lot of folks on both sides of the aisle who do want to investigate this. It's just not going to be possible to have a serious congressional investigation in these circumstances without bipartisan support. So I do think that to the extent that that lawmakers have said, hey, we need to pay attention to this, there are genuine efforts behind the scenes to investigate Russia and investigate the ties between the Trump camp and Russia. Now, are they going to be able to do it seriously? How deep are they going to be able to probe? Those are the questions I'm trying to answer. And so our report discussed that, hey, you know, the Senate Intelligence Committee until recently has only had 7 staffers, and none of them are dedicated to it full time. They all have other responsibilities and jobs to do on the Intelligence Committee. And it raises the question, ultimately, can you have a serious and deep investigation into something as complex that requires knowledge in prosecutions, forensic accounting, Russian language skills, an understanding of lobbying law, understanding about intelligence and raw intelligence and intercepts and so on and so forth, with just a small group of seven people doing this investigation part time. I suggest no, and I think a lot of people don't think that that's sufficient.
Well, but doesn't history indicate that it's not just insufficient? It's almost a joke compared to the number of staffs on Iran-Contra and all these other investigations. This is just dwarfs by comparison, does it not? And not having the prosecutorial skills, the investigative skills, and the language skills on the surface would make you wonder, well, why did Senator Warner even think that they were making progress in the first place? I mean, is it really up to the chairman to decide how many and who gets hired in terms of the staff?
You know, the Intelligence Committee in the Senate has traditionally been a very bipartisan body. That is, the chairman has a lot of responsibility and a lot of prerogatives. But nothing gets done unless there's broad bipartisan support. I think what you're seeing with Senator Warner, who's the top Democrat on that committee, is that he really wants to keep a sense of comedy on the committee, wants to keep moving forward. He said that he wants the investigation to move more quickly. But there is, I think, a sense of frustration among some members of that committee that it's not moving quickly enough. And, you know, putting aside politics and putting aside, you know, what individual lawmakers will say, the fact of the matter is, like you mentioned, if you look at the statistics and you look at the number of staff, their backgrounds, if you want to do a serious investigation, it's not going to be enough.
And again, I'm speaking with Tim Mak, who's a senior correspondent for The Daily Beast, where he covers campaign politics, national security, and Congress. His latest article at The Daily Beast is Senate Democrats Have Serious Concerns About Trump-Russia Probe. Well, they did have one hearing, which, frankly, I thought was pretty impressive. I thought the testimony by Clinton Watts was very impressive and very helpful, and it seemed as though they were really laying the groundwork to do some very important work. And that was like an opening salvo that sort of educated the public about the broad parameters of cyber espionage, etc. And I think Clint Watts gave an extremely comprehensive portrait of how aggressive the Russians are and have been and continue to be. What was your impression of it?
I think that there are good intentions on the Senate Intelligence Committee, but good intentions aren't going to conduct an investigation. I think there are a lot of friendships on the Senate Intelligence Committee and a lot of bipartisan spirit. That alone will not give the public the answers that I think polls show they want about what happened with Russian interference in the U.S. elections, and also were there any ties between the Trump campaign and Trump's orbit and the Russian government. Goodwill will just simply not accomplish that. And seven part-time investigators without prosecutorial experience and without experience in complex investigations, you just think of it as too large of a load for them to bear just that small number of them.
Well, it seems like Senator Ron Wyden and some of the Democrats on the committee already know that. I mean, it's hard not to think that they do know that, and whether this is being intentionally slow walked or, I mean, I'm not sure. When you talk to Senator Byrd, does he give you reasons why they are so understaffed with such an important issue that has the nation's attention? I mean, you can't help but notice for the last several months, this has been the subject of headlines for the longest time. So there is a disconnect there, surely.
Well, when you talk to the chairman, he'll give you his take on, which is that they are proceeding apace, that they're investigating thoroughly, and they're moving methodically. And the reason why it's not going as quickly as some others might like it is because they're being very careful and very thorough. And they're reviewing documents, and they're trying to get to a place where they make more progress that they can discuss publicly. That would be what he would say if he were on your show right now, I imagine.
But they have gone over to the CIA, right? And they've looked at some of the raw intelligence that apparently is the basis for why there was the consensus of all 17 intelligence services that I think the report came out in December, did it not, saying that the Russians were involved, and then the orders came from Putin himself. And apparently in some of that raw intelligence, there is some indication to support those charges. But if the senators get those kind of briefings or get access to that kind of information and they return to the committee and you've got seven part-time staffers who aren't necessarily trained, does it simply go nowhere? I mean, what happens to all that information that the senators have?
Well, you know, it suggests an investigation that could take years to complete. I mean, this is, you know, when you think about other investigations, Iran-Contra, the Senate Intelligence Committee's review of the WMD evidence in the lead-up to the Iraq War, or if you look at the Senate torture report, these are all things that took years to accomplish, and they had more resources. You know, I mean, we look at the seven part-time investigative, the seven part-time staffers and what they'll have to investigate. I mean, it seems to me a whole league more complex and more and what you could say important to conduct this.
But when senators like Ron Wyden, the Democratic senator, expresses frustration, at the same time you got Senator Warner trying to maintain the comedy that that they've had, and I recall the photo opportunity with Senator Burr and Senator Warner, more or less making it clear that they're not like the House. Well, that was at the time that the Devin Nunes antics were happening. So what's going on behind the scenes there? Is there a sort of a battle going on between those that are frustrated at the slow pace and the inadequate staff want to move forward, and at the same time, the chairman, at least the vice chairman, the Democratic head, doesn't really want to push it too far to create a rift with the Republican chairman? There's got to be a sort of political explanation for this, is there, in terms of politics and personality?
Well, I think the temptation is always to kind of to try to view these political committees through the lens of parties and partisanship and perhaps partisan dysfunction. And I don't know that that's the case. I think the story here is a story of resources. It's a story of not necessarily partisan issues, but disagreements over the configuration of the committee. This is a lack of investigative muscle, that there are disagreements on how that funding can occur to get more staff and if it's necessary. I'm not sure I'm ready to say that the committee is in the place it is because of partisanship, but I am ready to say that they haven't done as much work as they could have if they had been properly structured and they had the staffing to investigate what they said that they would investigate.
But then that leads you to the question of Senator Burr. And we know, of course, Senator Burr, the chair, was on the Trump campaign during the election. And he, as I mentioned earlier, he had the press conference with his vice chairman, Democrat Senator Warner, saying that they were working together and they had bipartisanship. But if he's in charge and he can, in fact, get the money. I mean, I guess that's my question to you. Can he get the money? Can he get the resources? Is there something beyond his power that is preventing them from having sufficient staff to take on this incredibly important role?
I'm not sure. I know, and I reported in my story that they have $1.2 million earmarked for this investigation. Much of that has not been allocated, so they may expand their staff. In fact, they said that they're going to expand it to nine, but they'll, you know, all nine individuals will have other responsibilities. I don't want to presume to know what's going on inside the heads of some of these members, but I think the facts speak for themselves. You know, whether it's seven or it's nine, it pales. That number pales in comparison to the scope and the size of the task before them.
Well, then, does it mean, is one left with going back to my original sort of question about the broader issues of whether the politics of distraction involved in here, whether there's, we know that it looks as though Devin Nunes deliberately sort of wrecked the ability of the House committee. And as you say in your article, in closing, but with the House, it's been a public fiasco. With the Senate, it's been a private tragedy. Is there, to your mind, are you satisfied that Senator Burr is not deliberately slow walking this investigation?
I don't have any evidence that the chairman of the committee is deliberately slow walking the investigation, and I don't have any reporting that backs that up. So I don't want to suggest that to be the case. It may or may not be the case that Republicans are less interested in investigating than Democrats. But the whole point of this is to say Republicans and Democrats need to agree that more resources should be dedicated to this investigation if they want to fully and comprehensively investigate the things they said they would investigate. That what is currently before us is not sufficient, given the size of the task.
Well, are we going to see Sally Yates and Brennan and Clapper, who were, well, that was actually on the House side, was it not, that they were scheduled to give testimony? In other words, is there anything scheduled that at least we can look towards that is going to come out of that committee?
From the Senate Intelligence Committee right now, they don't have any hearing scheduled. The House Intelligence Committee has a closed hearing scheduled for May 2nd, and they hope to bring in Sally Yates and other national security officials soon thereafter. The Senate Judiciary Committee has scheduled a meeting with Sally Yates for May 8th.
Well, just in closing, Tim Mak, a lot of people think that at the end of the day, what really is necessary is an independent commission like the 9/11 Commission that has its own funding that can actually hire really professional investigators, Russian language skills, etc., former intelligence people, which certainly was the case with 9/11. And it took about a year, I think, to get 9/11 off the ground. The Bush administration did resist it for the longest time. So at the end of the day, is that, do you think, what we might eventually be looking at?
I think ultimately the committees will try to get to the bottom of it, but they lack the resources to do a fulsome investigation into what happened with Russia in terms of their interference in the election and whether there were any ties between the Trump camp and the Russian government. It really depends on who controls the House and Senate in coming years. I mean, this is, as you said, the 9/11 Commission took quite a long time to get off the ground, despite the fact that 9/11 was clearly a topic worth investigating. Here, a lot of Republicans are reluctant to investigate the president, simply or partially because he's a member of their party. And so I think the chances for a special, rather a select committee, will go up depending on whether or not Democrats control the House or Senate. As for a commission, the president needs to sign legislation for a commission. So while Trump is president, it's unlikely that such a commission would ever occur.
Well, Tim Mak, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Tim Mak, who's a senior correspondent for The Daily Beast, where he covers campaign politics, national security, and Congress. His latest article at The Daily Beast is Senate Democrats Have Serious Concerns About Trump-Russia Probe. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into cheap and effective alternatives to Trump's border wall.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sonia Nazario, who spent more than 20 years reporting and writing about social issues, most recently as a projects reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her six-part investigative series, Enrico's Journey, which is now a best-selling book. And her latest op-ed at the Los Angeles Times is How to Secure the Border. Spoiler alert, a wall won't do it. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sonia Nazario.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Sonia. And it looks as if Donald Trump has had reality intrude a little bit. At least he's indicating that he's going to ditch plans to look for money for his border wall in this week's spending bill. Clearly, this will avoid a government shutdown. But in a meeting with members of the conservative media on Monday night, he said he would be finding money for the wall later in the year. But in your article in the Los Angeles Times, How to Secure the Border, spoiler alert, a wall won't do it, you point out that we're already spending about $20 billion a year for enforcing the border. That in itself seems excessive.
Yes, we're spending an extraordinary amount to enforce border enforcement. And as I wrote, you know, obviously we have the right to protect our border. I believe in the rule of law, as do all Americans. But spending ever more money on border enforcement, we're talking about, you know, anywhere from $12 billion to nearly $67 billion are projections to build this wall, won't work. And we know that from past experiences. And you can ask the Chinese, who built the mother of all walls. It did not keep out the Mongols. But, you know, honestly, I say a plague on both the left and the right in terms of the approaches that we've tried for the last 40 years. We've tried border enforcement, and despite spending more and more and more and more agents on the border, 97% study show of those who try repeatedly are able to get through. We've tried guest worker programs, and yet people are supposed to come here legally, temporarily, and go home. But under the biggest guest worker program, the Braceros, from 1940s to the 1960s, more than half didn't go home. And that created the foundation of the wave of migration that followed from Mexico. And I think more center left, we tried legalization back in 1986, an amnesty. We went from 3 million to 1 million. But then people who legalized told friends and family down south, come on up. And now we're at 11 million. So obviously that didn't work, as our political leaders swore that it would solve illegal immigration as we know it. So I think we need a radically different approach to this, one that is not what Donald Trump or many others are talking about.
Well, but as a political issue, though, it seems to me that immigration crosses all kinds of political lines. And in effect, you have left-wing groups like MALDEF in bed with right-wing groups like agribusiness, etc. And then you have left-wing unions in bed with anti-immigrant groups like the Minutemen.
Yeah, I mean, I think this creates very strange bedfellows. And largely what we've gotten over the last many decades has been businesses' desire to have cheap, compliant workers in the United States to work in those meatpacking plants, to pick those crops. And I think it will be curious to see how far President Trump will be able to go before those business interests push back, as they did in Arizona with SB 1070. At a certain point, they say, this is not good for us. You need to stop doing this. And that's what we've seen historically. But the reality is that most people coming here are not coming from Mexico. They're coming from Central America. They're coming from three of the most violent countries on earth, and they are fleeing that violence. And I focus on immigrant children. The UN has found, interviewing these kids, that 6 out of 10 have been threatened in their home countries, mostly because of gangs, because of narco cartels that have taken control of large swaths of these countries. And these kids are simply fleeing for their lives. And so, as one expert told me, when your house is burning down, you're going to find a way to get out of that house. And that's what these children and other migrants are doing from Central America. And I sincerely doubt that a wall will stop them.
Well, Sean Spicer today in the White House press conference said, when he was sort of having to answer to the fact that Donald Trump was not going to insist on money for the wall, his wall, which originally Mexico was supposed to pay for. He's taking it out of the must-pass spending bills to avoid a government shutdown. Sean Spicer said the priorities have not changed. There will be a wall built. And then he went on to say it is important to prevent human trafficking gangs like MS-13 from coming in the flow of illegal drugs and immigration. So that is, they're sort of turning to that. But I find it very ironic in that MS-13, the El Salvadoran gang, which is apparently a cause of kids and their parents fleeing for their lives, coming north and going through the hazardous journey that you documented in Enrique's journey, Sonia Nazario, is that gang, MS-13, was actually created here in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. So the Mexicans had the 18th Street Gang, and during the wars in Central America in the 1980s, so many Central Americans came to Los Angeles and other cities, and the Mexicans would pick on them, so they formed their own gang, MS-13. And much of the part of the mayhem that has been created in Central America has been, to some degree, of the U.S.'s doing, because since the mid-90s, we toughened laws towards permanent residents who had committed certain offenses, broken certain laws, DUIs, drug offenses. And we have deported more than 300,000 criminals to Central America, many of them gangsters. And they were really the ones that started to form these extraordinarily violent gangs in Central America that are driving much of the mayhem there. We also spent $8 billion to disrupt the flow of drugs coming from Colombia, Venezuela. Those drugs used to come up in drug flights through the Caribbean, but we put the squeeze on, and so those narcos simply turned left and started landing 4 out of 5 of those narco flights in Honduras, which became, until this year, it was the number one homicide rate in the world of countries not at war. Today, El Salvador and Venezuela have supplanted Honduras, but it's still in the top 3 or 4. So these are extraordinarily violent countries, and the U.S. has had some measure to do with that.
And again, I'm speaking with Sonia Nazario, who has spent more than 20 years reporting and writing about social issues, most recently as a projects reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her 6-part investigative series, Enrique's Journey, which is now a best-selling book. And her latest op-ed at the Los Angeles Times is How to Secure the Border. Spoiler alert, a wall won't do it. Well, in a way, I suppose Newton's law is involved here. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. I don't know how much the wars that the United States got involved in the 1980s in El Salvador and Nicaragua led to this condition. I think the El Salvadoran refugees who came up here as a result of that war, that was the community in which MS-13 was sort of incubated. But I don't know whether you can make the case, for example, the rash of emigration into Europe a couple of years ago is a result of how the dominoes fell from the U.S. intervention in Iraq and the fact that the Middle East has been destabilized ever since. That's, I think, a conversation for another day, because I think what you've brought to the table in your op-ed in the Los Angeles Times is important enough in itself, and let's focus on that. Basically, what you're arguing is that instead of wasting money on this ridiculous wall, which could cost up to $20, $30 billion, at the expense, by the way, of cutting money from the State Department and just about everything else, what is working for much, much less money is violence prevention programs in countries like El Salvador and Honduras that make life more livable for people there so that they don't feel threatened and feel compelled to leave.
Yes, you know, my parents both migrated here from Argentina, and my personal experience is that most migrants would rather live in their home countries if they can, you know, eat enough to survive, and especially if they're not being threatened with death by these gangs and narcos. And we know what would work to slow the flow, because we've seen this in the last couple of years. You need to deal directly with the forces that are pushing people out of these three very violent countries to come to the United States. About a year ago, I went to the most dangerous neighborhood called Rivera Hernandez in the city of San Pedro Sula in Honduras. This city, for 4 years running, had the highest homicide rate in the world. It was the murder capital of the world, and this was the worst neighborhood within that city. 2 years ago, that neighborhood, there were bodies littering the streets in the morning. Six gangs controlled it with an iron fist. Kids did not go play outside in broad daylight. And the police found one day that these gangsters were playing soccer with the decapitated head of someone that they had just executed. The U.S. went into this neighborhood with a pilot program based on what they know has worked to reduce violence in Los Angeles and in Boston. And we funded outreach centers where kids can go and get mentors and help getting jobs to dry up the lifeblood of gangs, which are new recruits. We've gone into the schools in that neighborhood, and we identify which kids have some of the 9 risk factors for going into gangs, put them into a year of family counseling, and those kids end up 77% less likely to commit crimes and abuse drugs and alcohol. And then the third thing we did was we funded a nonprofit. You know, in Honduras, 96% of all homicides get no conviction. You can shoot someone broad daylight and get away with it because witnesses know if I step forward today, I am dead tomorrow. So they funded this nonprofit that goes into these neighborhoods and they investigate all homicides. And they coax reluctant witnesses to testify with a black burqa over their body, with rubber boots so the gangsters can't see what shoes they're wearing, with a voice distorter. And now more than half of homicides are getting guilty verdicts. We're helping bring justice to these neighborhoods and signal to gangs, you can no longer get away with killing people with impunity. So in this neighborhood, in 2 years, homicides dropped 62%. And what we've seen was it cut the number of kids fleeing Honduras by nearly half in 2 years. So we know what works, and we've tried this in a few pilot neighborhoods, and we should do this in more places because this is way cheaper. We're spending $100 million in Honduras on violence prevention versus spending billions once these children or other migrants arrive at our doorstep here in the United States. To me, this is a no-brainer. It is a win-win. It's a smart investment, especially versus spending on things like walls.
But why is it then that Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras are the main countries from which most of these refugees coming, many of them unaccompanied children fleeing for their lives? Their parents literally send them on this incredibly dangerous journey through Mexico that you have documented, Sonia Nazario, in Enrique's journey. And by the way, the U.S. spends money, gives money to the Mexican police to stop this flow of immigrants north. So that in itself is pretty shameful. But is there a reason why these narco states or even failed states like Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras are the source of this problem as opposed to Nicaragua? Why is Nicaragua different?
I think that Nicaragua much more adopted community-based policing where the police are less corrupt than you see in Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. So the police tend to live in the communities. They're more trusted by the communities. All the things that we've learned in Los Angeles that work in terms of policing, they've instituted much more strongly in Nicaragua. And that's why, and also it's less of a geographically a desirable place to move drugs than, say, Honduras. So government is also stronger in Nicaragua. So what you have are very weak governments in places like Honduras, very corrupt governments, very corrupt police. And that's part of the change that needs to take place. Is that the U.S. did help institute and bring about in places like Colombia was strengthening these government institutions, the Attorney General's office and other government institutions so that they can take on the narco cartels. In Honduras, the money that the narcos bring into the country is greater than the entire GDP of the country. So they can buy off a whole lot of judges and cops. And I mean, you have police officers who are making $8 million who make $1,000 a month and have very nice houses. So there is just rampant corruption among the police. And there are groups that are trying to bring greater transparency and purge the police and bring change to some of these fundamental institutions in places like Honduras and try to bring those kind of changes that are also necessary to reduce the flow of migrants.
But just to the broader picture, though, in the context of what happened today with the signal that Donald Trump is no longer going to insist on money for the wall, which Mexico was supposed to pay for, because he doesn't want that to be the issue over which the government is shut down over. And it's not popular, obviously, with Democrats. It's deeply unpopular, and it's not even popular with a number of Republicans. But it's based upon these campaign promises. And there's no question to my mind that both Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions have tried to create this kind of paranoid vision of a dystopian United States. He used in his inaugural address the word carnage. He talks about chaos in the inner cities that are apparently unlivable in this vision, this dystopian vision. Sessions keeps going around the country talking about we have the highest crime rate ever, and he's the top law enforcement. He's the top law enforcement officer. It's a complete lie.
That's so curious, isn't it?
Well, yes. But why are they doing that? Why are they presenting this? Because my sense is that trying to propagate this xenophobia and this vision of the United States beleaguered with this threatening world outside, and this general idea from the campaign that, you know, you can solve complex problems with simple solutions like building a wall. There was also this idea in building the wall and getting the Mexicans to pay for them. There was an unmistakable kind of racist tone that we, the powerful United States, are going to humiliate these smaller brown people and take their money and force them to pay. It was a clear act of dominance, making Mexico kneel before us and cough up. And of course,
over so well with a country who's had a third of its territory taken by the United States. Right. And believe me, they remember that.
Right.
So, you know, I think fear sells, and I think that people can visualize a wall. We have a fence with our neighbor, and it's a simple solution that people can visualize. But in reality, there are only two walls that have worked fairly successfully of the dozens and dozens. I mean, 70 are being built now around the world. The Berlin Wall, which had shoot-to-kill orders, which I'm hoping we don't resort to, and the Israelis, which is a very tiny country, and everyone is brought into military service at a young age. So you have a whole lot of people to watch that wall. But the reality is that this has been tried over and over again, and it has not worked. If anything, what we've seen with greater border enforcement is that if a decade ago half of the Mexicans went home within a year because they want to go home and see their families, now fewer than a quarter do because it's getting tougher to get in. The smuggling rates keep going up. So we are helping the criminal organizations by the border enforcement because smuggling rates go up and up and more people have to resort to those criminal organizations to be smuggled into the United States and across Mexico. So now fewer than a quarter of Mexicans go home, and knowing that they're going to have to stay here, they tend to bring their friends and their family members up more readily. So many believe who have studied this that this is, in many ways has been counterproductive to what we want to see. I want to see the flow of migrants coming here slow down. I want to see more people be able to stay in their home countries where they would rather live. But I think we need to be pragmatic about what actually works. And what we have seen actually works is dealing with these extraordinarily violent societies where, you know, many of these neighborhoods in Honduras where I go, these gangs recruit children when they are 9, 10, 11 years old. There was a boy in this neighborhood I spent time in. When he was 8, he started collecting cans, recycling them in this neighborhood to help feed himself. And when he was 9, the gang started pressuring him. You must join. They pressured every day. They wanted him to use that bag to move guns and drugs in the neighborhood for them. And he always said no. And when he was 10, they barged into his hut, held him down, 3 of them, and took turns raping him. This boy has witnessed a massacre of 15 people at one time. He's witnessed seeing hacked up bodies on the way walking to school. This is what these children are fleeing. And until that changes, until they feel that they can live with some measure of security in their communities, they will keep coming no matter what we throw at them. Mexico today, 18,000 Central Americans are being kidnapped by the narcos and by the cartels. They are being enslaved. They are being ransomed to people in the United States. If you don't pay up, they'll just kill that person that they've kidnapped. They are prostituting girls. They are killing people and harvesting their organs. Migrants know that this is what they will face trying to get through Mexico, and yet they are leaving these countries because what they see in their countries, they believe, is worse than that. Until that changes, they're going to keep coming.
Sonia Nazario, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sonia Nazario, who spent more than 20 years reporting and writing about social issues, most recently as a projects reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her six-part investigative series, Enrique's Journey, which is now a best-selling book. And her latest op-ed at the Los Angeles Times is How to Secure the Border. Spoiler alert, a wall won't do it. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether Russia is arming the Taliban.
Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count its ups. They lead you to the race, but no one's asked them to. دو چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنین نازداری به موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois and a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. He served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan for the United States Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and he's the author of The Future of Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marvin Weinbaum.
Hello, everyone.
So, Marvin, what do you make of the remarks by General John Nicholson, the general in charge of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan? He was meeting at a press conference with General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, who's on a tour, and he was responding to earlier anonymously well, it wasn't so much leaked, but it came from anonymous sources in the military saying that the Russians were sending weapons to the Taliban. And the General Nicholson said, we continue to get reports of this assistance. We support anyone who wants to help us advance the reconciliation process. But anyone who arms belligerents, who perpetuate attacks like the one we saw 2 days ago in Mazar-e Sharif, is not the best way forward to a peaceful reconciliation. So it doesn't sound like anybody's really sort of making concrete charges, but they're letting these charges sort of stay out there. So what do you make of this?
Yes, well, we're pushing back against the Russians, who clearly have, after more than 25 years of really staying out of Afghanistan, after all, they left under circumstances which were not the best for the Soviet Union and certainly contributed to its downfall. But what we are seeing, Ian, is Russia's efforts here to become a player in the region, particularly as they sense American vulnerabilities. Given the state of relations with the Russians, it's not surprising that they would try to take advantage of us. And right now, we do have our backs against the wall in Afghanistan, in that we've got no clear way forward here. And the Russians, well, I have a high regard for General Nicholson. I think everybody who's known him feels that way. But as you suggest, it's the statements that they're making are certainly not concrete ones. I think I would put it this way, Ian, that what they want here is they certainly want to see the Islamic State and not emerge as a powerful force in Afghanistan. And the Taliban and ISIS or Islamic State are not friends, and in fact sometimes even fight. So they want that. But more than that, my sense is that the way things are going there, they want to have a hand there in trying to create what that future is going to be like in Afghanistan if things go bad, and to keep lines open to the Taliban. It's a hedging strategy that if the Taliban play a much larger role in the future there, they want to be able to deal with them, if only to say to the Taliban, now look, we won't bother you in Afghanistan if you don't try to export your radical Islamic behavior across the borders. And I think Iran feels exactly the same way, and in a sense, so does Pakistan. All hedging strategies.
Well, specifically, an anonymous U.S. senior military official in Kabul earlier the day they had the press conference with the Secretary of Defense and General Nicholson said that Russia stepped up its assistance to insurgents over the last 18 months, providing machine guns and other medium weaponry to fighters in Helmand, Kandahar, and Uruzgan, but essentially to supply them with arms to fight the Islamic State in these areas. So that's as far as the charges go. So,
they're not fighting. Occasionally, they do have skirmishes with Islamic State, but right. As we've just seen there in Balkh province, where they killed they overran the military installation. They're using these arms, obviously, wherever they've gotten them for. They're using them against the Kabul government and its forces. I think they are using that as an excuse here. Now, as to whether they actually are providing, there's no question that Russian arms are getting in there. But hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there are multiple sources for getting Russian arms. So that's not a conclusive case, because they have discovered that these have an origin in Russia. So I would be very cautious, but it doesn't really matter here. The fact is, Russia wants to, after more than 25 years, as I say, wants to be part of the equation. And recently, they held a conference in Moscow, this number of countries were invited, where Russia was looking to orchestrate here what a peace agreement would look like with the Taliban. Of course, there really is out there very little likelihood that the Taliban are interested in any kind of political settlement at this point, when they think they're winning.
And again, I'm speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois and a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. He served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan for the United States Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and is the author of The Future of Afghanistan. So, but in a way, though, this is a bit strange, where you kind of pump up, or at least float, this idea of the perfidious Putin selling arms or giving arms to the Taliban to stitch up America. At the same time, so many analysts that I've talked to have told me that, almost every American that's died in that war, the blood is on the hands of the Pakistanis. So,
well, that's an overstatement. Look, there's no question that Pakistan has given safe haven to certainly the Taliban leadership. But right now, what has happened over the last few years is the Taliban have succeeded in establishing a infrastructure within Afghanistan where they're less dependent upon Pakistan. And the idea, which is generally accepted in many places, that Pakistan could, if it wanted, turn off the insurgency, I think that is unfounded. Pakistan has negative influence. It can be a spoiler if it looks like, for example, a peace agreement were in the cards. They could very well prevent it from happening. But that's not the same as being able to dictate to the Taliban. The Taliban have demonstrated for a long period that they don't really take orders from anyone.
So what do you think is going to happen in the short term here? Because the Taliban spring offensive, I mean, that's normally what happens in Afghanistan because of the winter and the mountains, etc. The fighting begins in the spring. The U.S. is about 8,400 troops in Afghanistan, and there's another 5,000 NATO troops and U.S. Central Command. I think they've asked for another 300, have they? 3,000 troops. But the general impression I get, and of course this was certainly highlighted by the Taliban attack on the young cadets who were military cadets who were unarmed coming back from the mosque when they were slaughtered, about 150 were killed and 100 wounded by the Taliban. You get the impression it's not just the Taliban are going away. They're on a roll, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And again, it's the Taliban that are the threat to the government, to the future of Afghanistan. Not Islamic State, but we have built that up because that Islamic State for us is the poster boy of the bad guys. But I wish we were spending more time focusing on the Taliban and stunting their coming offensive. And in fact, there really is no fighting season anymore in a way, as we have seen throughout the last few months. The Taliban, because they have established such strong roots within the country, are able to mount attacks through the year now. Having said that, there's no question that what is pending now is a major offensive on the part of the Taliban, where they are, they won't necessarily try to hold on to territory, but they will try to demonstrate at every opportunity that they can penetrate, whether it's in Kabul or anywhere else, they can penetrate wherever they choose. And in that sense, it's more like a Tet offensive, where they don't have to win. They have to merely create the psychological sense here that the government cannot protect people, and therefore get, of course, within the army and within the public to a sense here that time is not on the government side.
So, what kind of honest metrics are there in terms of a lot of the U.S. troops there and the additional 3,000 they're asking for are meant to help train the Afghan security forces? Well, we've been hearing that for almost a decade. And this is, by the way, the longest war in U.S. history. So my sense is that the Trump administration basically is a government of and by stunts. They just have a stunt. They throw a few cruise missiles and they drop this at Syria and then they drop the mother of all bombs. And from what I can understand, it wasn't particularly effective. There's no real concrete evidence of killing a bunch of Islamic State fighters that they've claimed to have done. And there's no clarity coming.
To the extent that there's anyone who's orchestrating our policy there, it's the generals on the ground there, mm-hmm. and they have asked for additional forces. The strategy going forward now, because the military really basically, there's continuity there in their thinking. The strategy is one of buying time for Afghanistan. There's little likelihood here that they can defeat the Taliban militarily, but the hope here is that if they can keep this government going for another 3-5 years, if this government can demonstrate that it can put its act together, and that means the military, that means the economic side of it, it means, very importantly, that they can reconcile the leadership among themselves. If they were able to do that because we bought them time with them, what is relatively a minimal investment compared to a few years ago when we had almost 100,000 troops there. Well, if we can do that, the thinking here is that no, we probably will still not be able to have a grand bargain with the Taliban, but that we can begin to erode support for the Taliban as the Taliban fighters themselves say, you know, we're better off striking a deal with the government than we are in continuing what looks like an endless war. That's really all we have, Ethan. Ian, we really don't have anything more than that. And I wouldn't put any money on that strategy, but it's what we have. And yes, it's still everywhere you see, well, let's strike a bargain with the Taliban. As I said before, there's no indication the Taliban have any interest in it. And we also have to keep in mind, they don't want to strike a bargain because they don't want to join a democratic constitutional government. They have the image of a Sharia state, which is radically different than what we would accept in terms of human rights, but in terms of really just generally governance. So that their vision of an Afghanistan is very different than our own, and we'll never be able, I think, to change the leadership on that. But we can begin with a government which has resilience here to, as I suggest, to begin to wean away elements from it, commanders who will go over to the government. It's a long shot, but again, it's the only, I think, option that we have.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, do you think there's anything we could do, for example, not that we have good relations with Iran, but I've always wondered why it is. I mean, we know, for example, that the Indians helped build a road from the Indian Ocean all the way up to through the Iranian border into Herat, was it not? They have let's face it, they have a dog in this fight. They have a border, yes. And there's a Shia minority there that they want to protect. I mean, will we end up with a kind of Northern Alliance situation where there's a sort of rump left of Afghanistan, and that the Taliban will control most of the east and the south?
Well, there are people out there who think that the way it will end up is that the country will be divided with an Iranian sphere of influence, a Pakistani sphere of influence, one from those who are closer to Russia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, that somehow this is the way it ends up. But that very honestly is a civil war. It's a civil war which I think is going to be disastrous for everybody. One thing that all of the neighboring countries have in common is that if they could see a prosperous, stable Afghanistan, and this includes Pakistan, this would be in their best interest. The trouble is that they have trouble believing it won't end up with a fractured state in which every one of them is going to be looking out for its own interests.
Well, Marvin Weinberg, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'll be speaking with Marvin Weinberg, Mr. Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois and a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. He served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan at the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and is the author of The Future of Afghanistan.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time was